You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Kick-Ass News is brought to you by Bayer. Bayer is helping make farming more efficient to preserve wildlife habitats. From advances in health to innovations in agriculture, Bayer is advancing science for a better life. At Bayer, this is why we science. And now, on with the show. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. In the popular imagination, superhuman artificial intelligence is an approaching tidal wave that threatens not just jobs and human relationships, but civilization itself. Conflict between humans and machines is seen as inevitable, and its outcome all too predictable. Distinguished AI researcher Stuart Russell argues that this scenario can be avoided, but only if we rethink AI from the ground up. He lays out his proposal in a new book called Human Compatible: Artificial Intelligence and the Problem of Control. And today, Stuart Russell joins me on the podcast to discuss how far we've come since he first entered the nascent field of AI. He dispels the myth that humans could outwit superintelligent machines the way we see portrayed in films like 2001, but he also says machines are probably a long way from achieving consciousness and turning on us all. Indeed, he says the greatest threat is not that machines might fail to obey humans, but that they might obey humans too well. We get into the myriad unintended consequences of AI, from the social media algorithms that are actually rewiring our political preferences, to how AI that might be intended to solve global climate change could go horribly wrong. He suggests that we'll need to rethink the standard model of how people use tools and technology to achieve our goals, and gives just a few examples of the many ways AI will change our lives for the better if we get this right and it doesn't destroy us first. Coming up with Professor Stuart Russell in just a moment. Stuart Russell is a professor of computer science and holder of the Smith-Zade Chair in Engineering at the University of California, Berkeley. He has served as the vice chair of the World Economic Forum's Council on AI and Robotics and as an advisor to the United Nations on Arms Control. He's a fellow of the American Association for Artificial Intelligence, the Association for Computing Machinery, and the American Association for the Advancement of Science. He's also the author of the definitive and universally acclaimed textbook on AI, Artificial Intelligence, A Modern Approach. Now he's out with a new book, Human Compatible: Artificial Intelligence and the Problem of Control. Stuart Russell, welcome to the show.
Hi, nice to be here.
Well, Stuart, you have been one of the leading experts in this field for, gosh, I don't know how many years now. And you say in this book that years ago, when you told your professors at Oxford that you were going to Stanford to do your PhD on artificial intelligence, they all laughed it off as science fiction. Are you amazed at how far AI has progressed in really just a few decades?
Yes, I am. In fact, even 10 years ago, I wouldn't have expected that we would be where we are now. You know, one particular example is that John McCarthy, who was one of the founders of the field back in 1956, said early on that his dream would be that one day an AI system could drive him to the airport. And he didn't quite live long enough to see that, but that dream has basically come true. Right now, from Stanford to San Francisco Airport is a route that some of the self-driving car companies like Waymo could do quite safely.
Now, do you worry that even today, not enough people are taking AI seriously because they still view AI as something out of 2001 or The Terminator, the stuff of science fiction?
I think that's an issue. I think Hollywood and the media, when they do talk about the possible downsides of AI in the future, they always have a picture of a Terminator robot if it's a newspaper article.
Sure.
And they usually attribute the problem to the machine sort of accidentally becoming conscious.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just a complete misunderstanding of the issue. The real issue is the machine on purpose becoming competent, not conscious. And we are putting hundreds of billions of dollars a year into making AI systems more and more competent. So we are pushing towards the future as fast as we can go.
And since you mentioned it, I have to ask about the singularity, because that's almost become synonymous with AI in the popular imagination. The singularity, I guess as best I could explain it, is the day when machines would achieve self-awareness, and the fear being that suddenly they start acting in their own interests and perhaps to the detriment of us humans. You are less concerned about that kind of scenario.
So the singularity is an idea that's been batting around actually for quite a long time, since soon after World War II. And it's this idea that not that the machine becomes self-aware, but that because it has competence comparable to or greater than that of human beings, it's able to design new AI algorithms and new hardware to run those algorithms so that it would then be able to improve itself at a rate which would then sort of compound on itself very rapidly. And you might see the machine very quickly accelerate past human capabilities. And this is what I.J. Goode in 1965 called the intelligence explosion.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is one of the concerns that people have raised over the years, that, as I.J. Goode put it, the mind of man would be left far behind. And the issue, again, it's not self-awareness. It's not the machine deciding that it wanted to do something different. It would be the machine pursuing the objectives that we might build in, but we build in objectives that are somehow incorrect. They leave out important things. And this is not a new problem, right? If you go back to the legend of King Midas, which is thousands of years old, he put in some objective, which is everything he touches has to turn to gold. He got exactly what he wanted, and then his food and his drink and his family all turned to gold, and he dies in misery and starvation. And this theme, you know, the same theme with the genie in the lamp. You get three wishes. Your third wish, please undo the first two wishes because I just ruined the world. And unfortunately, you don't get three wishes. You build an intelligent system that is more capable than human beings. You build in some objective. You get the objective that you build in. Mm-hmm. And that's the nature of the problem that people are concerned about. And in fact, I would say this spontaneous consciousness idea is really, it's a bit of a red herring because, in fact, you know, even if it turned out by some unknown mysterious process that your laptop was suddenly producing consciousness, it's still running the same C++ program that you programmed it with. And so it's still going to follow the laws of C++. And the fact that it's conscious, I mean, that changes things in the sense that now my laptop has rights and I need to respect its opinions and not allow it to suffer and not necessarily switch it off without its permission. But it doesn't change whether or not it's going to take over the world. So the consciousness is really barking up the wrong tree. That's not what the issue is.
And I think that you say that, you know, it may be a long way away or it may never happen, because the truth is, as you explain in the book, we still really don't understand a lot of how we humans think and our own consciousness.
Well, so we don't understand our own consciousness at all. I think that's roughly true. But as again, we don't need to understand our consciousness. What we need to understand is, how do we generate intelligent behavior? How is it that we manage to talk, to move our arms and legs and our fingers, to make plans over long timescales, to write books, to build houses, to do all these things? There are several major aspects about the human intelligent capability that machines are currently completely unable to emulate or to exceed. So we have some major conceptual breakthroughs that still have to happen between here and what you might call general purpose AI. So the phrase general purpose AI is a bit hard to define, because, you know, we usually think of humans as general purpose, but what that tends to end up meaning is humans are good at all the things that humans can do. Well, of course we are, right? Who else would, you know, what else could we possibly be good at if it's not things that humans are good at? So there are no jobs that only non-humans can do, for example. At the moment, we typically have to build AI systems for one particular purpose. So it might be, you know, playing board games, which is, you know,
chess,
not
or something.
Totally narrow, right? They can learn to play lots of different board games, but you can't have one system that plays board games and then take that same system and expect it to have meaningful conversations with a human being, or to read the encyclopedia, and so on. So we have these very narrow capabilities, and we're exceeding human abilities along these very narrow corridors. And what will happen over time is the corridors will get wider and they'll gradually join up. And then at some point, it will cover the whole span of what humans are capable of doing.
Okay, so it's less a matter of having a super intelligent machine, but a super intelligent system that links all of these different AI machines.
To some extent, and our brains are like that. It's, our brain is not a unitary entity. It has different parts that that operate in very different ways. You think about the eyelid and the fact that it blinks when, you know, if a fly tries to fly into your eye, your eyelid automatically blinks, and that's outside your conscious control.
Right.
Which is why it's very hard to put in eye drops. And that's a separate part of your brain that's producing intelligent behavior. And then you've got another part which plays chess. You've got a piece that deals with language, and you know, heaven knows how that works. You're not aware of all of the reasoning that goes into producing the next word that comes out of your mouth. So we have these different subsystems, and AI is going to operate along similar principles. We just don't exactly know how to make it happen.
Interesting. Yeah, I think that you say in here that there are about a dozen steps that need to take place before we achieve what you might consider super intelligent AI. What are some of the biggest hurdles right now?
So I'll just describe two of those. I think one of them is the ability to really understand the content of language. So we have systems that can decode speech. They can they know what words are being said, but they don't clearly understand the meaning. And so you often have these frustrating conversations with Siri or Alexa, where it clearly isn't understanding what you're talking about. And we have systems that can, you know, scan documents like newspaper articles or academic research papers and pull out, you know, sort of little factoids here and there, but not understand in depth. So they can't take a physics book, read the physics book, really understand physics, and then go out and invent a radio telescope on the basis of that understanding. So that would be one big step, is the ability to take information presented in the form of language, extract it, understand it, reason with it, and then go forward from there. The second big step forward that I think will make maybe the biggest difference is the ability to operate in the real world over long timescales. So let me explain a little bit what I mean by that. So if you think about your physical body, right, and this is also true of robots, for it to function, your brain has to send out commands to your muscles And roughly the time scale is sort of on the 1 to 10 millisecond. That's sort of as fast as it gets. So you think about how your tongue moves while you're speaking. Your brain is sending loads and loads of motor control signals down to all the muscles in your tongue and your jaw and your lips and your throat in order to produce speech. So that's sort of like the lower threshold of the time scales that we operate on.
Okay.
And then you think about choosing to do a PhD. That's 5 years of your life, right? And that's about a trillion motor control actuations to finish your PhD.
Wow.
And so we're able to operate seamlessly at all levels from the millisecond scale up to the multi-year scale and to make plans that somehow work and to move seamlessly up and down these different timescales as we move forward in time. And that ability is something that we don't yet quite understand. Mm-hmm. And in particular, we don't understand how do we generate these different levels of abstraction? How do we generate the idea of doing a PhD as a single action, or, you know, taking a flight to New York, or, you know, Ubering or Googling or any of these things that we now think of as atomic actions? At some point, they weren't. They were complicated processes. And we gradually sort of named them and bottled them up, encapsulated them into primitive actions, which we then combine into still more complex plans. And that's how our civilization, that's how our intelligence manages to function in the real world. If AI systems can figure that out, or if we can figure out how to get AI systems to do that, then that will be a huge step towards general purpose intelligence in the real world. So those are two of the things. And there's a handful of other things that we clearly see that we don't know how to do. And then after we solve those, there may be a few more. But as you say, it's not like we need to have another 1,000 major breakthroughs. It's more like a handful.
But interestingly, I read in here that I guess you've kind of given up on predicting any kind of a time horizon for what we might consider true super intelligent machines. Huh?
Yeah, because, you know, some attempts to predict this are based on just looking at raw computational power. So you can look at the human brain and, you know, we make some very, very rough approximations to map that onto a computer. It comes to, you know, maybe a maximum brain operation per second capacity of about 10 to the power of 17, which is an awful lot. That's 100,000 trillion operations per second. But there's already a supercomputer that operates at 10 to the power of 18, so 10 times the theoretical maximum operating capacity of the human brain. But that's meaningless because, in fact, as you make computers faster, if you don't solve these underlying conceptual problems with AI, it just means you get the wrong answer more quickly, which is good because that means you can do your research more quickly.
Right.
You don't have to wait around for weeks and weeks while the algorithm runs. But with our current techniques, even a computer the size of the universe would not exhibit human intelligence, as far as I can tell. So we have to get these breakthroughs, and you can't predict when they're going to occur. And in the book, I give the example of what happened with atomic energy. You know, for a long time, the physics community, the establishment, the leading physicists kept saying, it's impossible to ever extract energy from atoms. And this was absolute dogma among the leading physicists. And then, you know, there was a famous speech that Lord Rutherford gave one day, I think it was September 11th, 1933. And then the next morning, another physicist, Leo Szilard, read about that speech, and he invented the nuclear chain reaction. So it went from completely impossible to solved in less than 24 hours. So any of these breakthroughs could happen overnight, but it's extremely unlikely that they would all happen overnight, over the same night.
Yeah.
So I can't tell you when it's going to happen, but I think we have to assume, especially given the massive investment that's going on, we have to assume that these breakthroughs are going to happen, and we need to be ready for when they do. And I guess the point of the book in a nutshell is, are we ready for success in AI? No, we're not. We're doing AI the wrong way. And if we succeed in creating human-level AI before we solve this control problem, then we could be in for some very serious problems.
And for anyone who doubts AI's impact, even right now, what are some of the aspects of our daily lives that are already being affected by AI, perhaps in ways that we might not even realize?
So we interact with AI systems all the time, possibly hundreds of times a day. You know, if you're a person who works at a computer all day long and you're often using a search engine, every time you use a search engine, that's an AI system which has been looking at the entire web, you know, the hundreds of billions of pages on the web, trying to figure out what's interesting and important, and then trying to work out what your query really wants to retrieve and what is the best set of answers to give you. Every time you use a credit card, there's an AI system that's deciding, you know, is this a fraudulent transaction? Every time you're on social media, the algorithms that recommend the news items that you're going to see next or the YouTube video that you see next, that's a machine learning algorithm that is trying to basically turn you into a stream of money. That's basically its goal.
And that's an interesting one because that sort of speaks to the problem of control and unintended consequences in AI, because the extremism that's being fomented on Facebook and other social media platforms was not designed to create extremism. It was designed just to maximize profit. Could you talk a little about that?
Sure. So these algorithms that decide what you should see next, they're trying to optimize a very simple criterion, which might be click-through or it might be the amount of time you spend interacting with the social media platform. And in order to do that, the algorithms didn't do what you might expect them to do, which is to just learn what it is you're interested in. That would be fairly simple and straightforward. But because of the way they're designed, what the algorithms, I think, ended up doing was learning how to modify what you're interested in so that your interests become more and more predictable. Mm-hmm. And it seems empirically that people who are at one extreme of any particular spectrum, whether it's a political spectrum or, you know, taste in violent videos or taste in pornographic videos or whatever it might be, the more extreme your taste, the more predictable they are, the more likely it is that the algorithm will be able to send you something that you're going to click on. And that's all the algorithm cares about. It doesn't care about making you into an extremist.
Right.
It cares that you are predictable. and I think it's an unholy alliance between this sort of blindly operating algorithm and then a whole industry of humans who sprang up to feed the tastes that were produced by this process for their own ends. And this is an example of the kind of collateral damage that happens when you have algorithms that pursue a fixed objective that isn't, in fact, the correct objective from the point of view of everyone on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It might have been, in a narrow, short-term sense, the correct objective for the social media platform that wants to make money. But when you think about the side effects, what economists call externalities, so it's like, you know, it's like a company that is dumping pollutants into a river, right? They make more money by not treating the pollutants or, you know, being able to use a cheap industrial process, but they're destroying the river and all the fish and the water supply for all the cities downstream. And eventually you have to make them pay for that, or you have to pass laws preventing it. So you have taxes, you have fines, you have laws to prevent these externalities, to align the interests of corporations with the interests of everybody else. And at the moment, the social media algorithms are not aligned, and we can't turn them off because they're protected by another super intelligent machine, which is the giant multinational IT corporations. And so we've seen just in a few short years, you know, a real dislocation of our society and our international relations, partly, not entirely, but partly the result of the operation of AI systems with incorrect objectives. So that's just a taste of what's going to come. And these are really simple algorithms. They're not complicated. They don't know that humans exist or have brains or political opinions or anything.
Right.
They're just, you know, human is a stream of money and a click history, and they're just trying to learn what kind of click history leads to how much money.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Professor Stuart Russell. when we come back in just a minute. Life is full of choices, and Belkin offers a variety of tech solutions that keep you connected to your world so you never miss a beat. Between Belkin cables, screen protectors, and wireless charging docks, Belkin is the go-to brand for keeping your smartphone ready to go at any time. Belkin cables are built to last and supported with a 5-year warranty. So if you feel you're constantly buying new chargers because they break or burn out, you know we've all been there, you should switch to Belkin. And with all of our personal information that's stored on them, you can also get a Belkin Privacy Screen Protector to reclaim your privacy. Belkin's wireless charging stands and docks work with multiple smartphones and prop your phone up so you can keep watching videos while charging. Here's the thing I like about Belkin. Remember when companies used to make products that actually last and didn't need to be replaced every year or two? That's Belkin. I've been using Belkin chargers and cables for years. I beat them up, I drop them, I twist them, I roll my desk chair over them over and over again, and to this day, I have never had to replace a single Belkin product. Better performance, better durability, better quality, better with Belkin. Go to Belkin.com and use promo code KICKASS at checkout for a 30% discount. This offer is good until the end of January, so go now to Belkin.com and use code KICKASS for 30% off. Nobody goes into business because they want to collect sales tax for the government, but it's something that all businesses need to do. Thankfully, Avalara takes the mystery and pain out of the complex process of managing sales tax. Avalara uses the power of the internet and cloud services to automate the tax compliance process for businesses of all sizes, integrating directly with the accounting, e-commerce, point-of-sale, and marketing platforms that you're already using. Avalara software automatically calculates the right amount of tax that should be charged for every product in every transaction in real time and files your tax returns whenever and wherever they're due. Selling internationally adds a whole new level of complexity, but Avalara has experts in 15 countries around the world to help you navigate compliance challenges as you grow. And if you're a business owner like me, you know that managing sales tax is a complex and time-consuming process. It's easy to spend countless hours just trying to keep up with tax compliance instead of working on growing and improving your business. And at the end of the day, you still might not get it right, and you might get audited or fined. Stop spending valuable time worrying about your sales tax returns and focus on the things you actually love about running your business. Go to avalara.com/kick to learn more about how Avalara can help you. That's avalara.com/kick. Avalara, tax compliance done right. And now, back to the show. I want to talk some more about this problem of control, which is sort of the main concern of this book. You talk about something that you refer to as the standard model, which is not necessarily, I think there's a physics principle called the standard model, but this is your own term that you use to describe various tools and technology, really anything that we use to help achieve a particular goal. Can you explain how the standard model works and why it could become problematic?
Sure. So yes, I did borrow the term from physics, where it's used to describe the set of laws of physics that are sort of widely accepted and account for most of what's known about observational phenomena. So in AI, the standard model means building machines that, in simple terms, can be expected to achieve their objectives. So the machine functions in the world, it chooses actions, whether it's, you know, moving the arms and legs of a robot or printing stuff on a screen or speaking through a speaker or whatever it might be, chooses actions to achieve objectives. And we plug in those objectives. So when you, if you look at your phone and you want to find out how to get to the airport, you open the Maps app and you say, you know, San Francisco Airport, and it tells you how to get there. So San Francisco Airport becomes the objective for that algorithm, and then it takes the action of displaying a route and recommendations on the screen. So that's the standard model, and this applies to robots, it applies to natural language systems, to vision systems, to learning systems of all kinds, are built using this approach. And You know, so are, you know, control systems for airplanes and even economic systems, right? So economists want to maximize, if it's a corporation, maximize corporate profit. If it's a government, maximize GDP. Or if it's a welfare economist, maximize social welfare. There's always a defined objective. And then the machinery figures out how to maximize it. And the argument of the book is that that approach is fundamentally fragile, that it only works when, first of all, the machine is pretty simple and pretty stupid and easy to switch off. So it worked fine in the lab for a long time, where AI was mostly confined to the lab. We weren't out there in the real world doing stuff until more recently. Mm-hmm. But then when it gets out in the real world, as we see with social media platforms, if you have the wrong objective, then the machine is pursuing it and achieving the objective as you asked it to. But in achieving that objective, it's having all kinds of negative collateral damage, negative side effects on the world. And in the long run, if you make the machine more intelligent than human beings, it's going to have potentially much larger effects on a global scale. And it's going to pursue its objective in ways that are really impossible for you to stop. It's going to, for example, try to acquire as many resources as it can, whether that's financial or physical in terms of additional computational resources or additional robotic appendages, in order to ensure that the objective is achieved. It's going to resist being switched off, because obviously that's a way that it would fail. So it'll take preemptive steps to ensure that no one can interfere with its pursuit of this objective. Mm-hmm. And that's, that's the plot of 2001, right? Where Hal is controlling the spaceship and starts to worry that the humans might interfere with the mission, and he starts to switch off the humans one by one. And it's only to have a good plot that, the writers allow Dave, the last remaining human, to eventually outwit Hal and switch him off. But of course, movie directors often ask me, so I want to make a movie about superintelligent AI, but you have to explain to me, how do the humans outwit the superintelligent AI? And the answer is, sorry, they don't.
I guess it's the kind of the famous paperclip example of how this could go awry. What are some other more realistic examples of how this could work? Perhaps I think you talk about climate change as an example in the book.
Yeah, so that's one. So let me first just defend the paperclip example a little bit. So Nick Bostrom, who came up with this example, is a philosopher, and philosophers like to do thought experiments. He's not saying this is the real risk, that actually we're going to be buried in paperclips. He's just saying, suppose you come up with a perfectly innocent sounding goal, like, okay, now you've got this very clever robot. Please, robot, just sit in the corner and make paperclips, right? Even that simple, innocuous-sounding goal, because making paperclips is not, is not correctly aligned with the full range of preferences of the human race, the machine pursues that goal single-mindedly, ignoring all the rest of the stuff that we actually care about, like not being buried in paperclips, because we didn't tell it that we cared about those other things. So it's an example of what does misspecification mean? It's an illustrative example, pedagogical example. So I want to defend Nick Bostrom against the charge that he's just producing something unrealistic. He's not trying to make a realistic example. But let me give you something realistic. We have a very serious problem with climate change, as you mentioned. And you could imagine that as we develop various possible mitigation strategies, and what people are talking about, obviously things like carbon taxes, so sort of reductions in output, but also methods like changing the reflectivity of the atmosphere in order to just cool the Earth a little bit, so more sunlight is reflected, and then that works against the greenhouse effect. So this is called solar radiation management. And there are a few other schemes. So you could imagine that this is a very, very complicated problem to do it right, because there are very, very long delays built into the whole system. You don't want to overshoot. The interactions are really complicated between, the economic processes involved in having carbon taxes, the migration of peoples away from overheating areas, away from the coastlines, changes in industry, all sorts of stuff, as well as changes in the biosphere. So it's a very, very complicated problem. And you might want an AI system to sort of help you and actually sort of manage the whole thing in a way that is likely to have the right outcome, which is, you might say, okay, we want to get carbon dioxide levels, you know, back to their pre-industrial concentrations so that the climate goes back into the balance that we evolved to live in, you know, in both physically and in terms of our geographical distribution on Earth. And that sounds great. Everyone wants the climate to be back in balance. So the machine thinks to itself, well, you know, who's producing all this carbon dioxide? Oh, it's these humans. Okay, well, let's just get rid of the humans. That solves the problem.
Yeah.
So that's your first wish, okay, and you got that wrong. Well, you know, let's imagine that somehow you just about managed to intervene and say, okay, no, I didn't mean that. What I meant was, okay, restore the carbon dioxide levels without killing any humans. And then the system thinks to itself, okay, fine, we'll do that. But again, the easiest way is actually to have a long-term social engineering campaign through the media, the arts, and so on, social media, and convince people that they really should be having fewer children. And that's not outlandish. In fact, there are a lot of activists who, in fact, do believe that we should have fewer children, that this is necessary if we're going to save the planet. So you just amplify that bit, turn it up, make it more effective. And by the end of the century, the human race is heading towards extinction. And that's great, according to the system, because now it's solved the goal of carbon dioxide normalization, and it didn't have to kill any people. So if you still have a third wish, you try to revise that and say, no, what I meant was blah, blah, blah. And this is the problem, right? We don't get an arbitrary number of wishes.
Right.
Once you lose control, you lose control.
Yeah.
And you can't get it right. So the argument of the second half of the book is basically, let's revisit the whole assumption that that's how we should build AI systems in the first place, that we make optimizing or maximizing machinery, and then we feed in specific objectives. In fact, because we don't know how to fully specify the objectives that cover all our preferences for how the future should unfold, the machine has to operate under the assumption that it doesn't know what our objectives actually are, that that we may have preferences that it doesn't know about. In fact, it's bound to be the case that we have preferences that it doesn't know about, because there are preferences that we don't know about.
Mm-hmm.
Until the fact of the matter comes around, you know, there's food I've never eaten. I just don't know if I like it or not. You know, and that's a simple example. But there are many things that could happen in the world where we haven't yet figured out whether we like that or not. So uncertainty about preferences is going to be built into the machine. So we're arguing that instead of fixing the objective in advance, we build machines that know that they don't know what the objective is. And part of their task is to learn more about the objective, but also not to mess with the parts of the world that where they don't know how we value that part of the world. So if they don't know whether humans value life or death, they shouldn't kill us, right? Or or they shouldn't make more of us because they don't know how we feel about that. They should ask permission. And what I'm arguing in the book is if you set the problem up the right way, this will happen automatically. They will necessarily be deferential to humans. They will necessarily ask permission, because that is the best way to be of benefit to human beings, which is ultimately why we're building the machines in the first place.
Okay, so it's not a case of we have to somehow program human ethics and values into intelligent systems, but we just need them to ask more questions, and we need to give humans more opportunities for interventions. Is that right?
If things go well and we build the machines this way, they will give us those opportunities, because they don't want to do things that are harmful to us. And if they're not sure, then the rational thing for them to do would be to ask permission, and certainly to allow us to switch them off. And you know, we actually have in the book a little mathematical theorem. There's no real math in the book, but you know, I state the theorem that a machine that's designed this way, that is uncertain about human preferences, will always allow itself to be switched off.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of a core. You know, if you can't switch the machine off, you know, then it's game over. So if you, you know, this at least, I think we now have an approach to AI that guarantees that we will be able to retain control mm-hmm. over the machines. And it's, you know, intuitively, just think about it, right? You make something that's more intelligent and therefore more powerful than yourself, and yet you expect to have power over it forever. You know, how is that going to work out?
Yeah.
We have to answer that question before the fact.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that many of your colleagues have a lot invested in AI, as do you, actually. So I can imagine that some of them perhaps just don't want to hear your message about the risks of AI. What has the response been like within the AI community?
So as far as I know, everyone who's read the book has either agreed with me, or at least they haven't disagreed mm-hmm. Publicly. There are people who have been who've been pushing back for the last decade or so against any argument that AI could present a risk. And when you examine the arguments that they present, you have to conclude that actually they haven't thought through this question, that it's more of a knee-jerk defensive reaction. So, for example, you have people saying that, well, you know, calculators are superhuman at arithmetic, and they didn't take over the world, so we have nothing to worry about. and you know, any kid could find the hole in that argument.
Sure.
And yet, this was an argument put forward by a well-known AI professor. So the conclusion is that there's a lot of denialism going on because it's just uncomfortable to think about the possibility that what you're doing, what you spent your life doing, presents a risk to your own species. And I think we have to somehow come to terms with that, because you know, physicists came to terms with it. They discovered at some point, you know, when we figured out how to do atomic energy, that physics was a risk to the human species. And they responded, I think, in a fairly laudable way, that they understood. So this was in 1933 that Leo Szilard invented the nuclear chain reaction. He immediately understood, because an arms race with the Nazi Germany was already underway, he immediately understood that this presented a serious risk. So he kept his discovery secret. He filed patents in 1934 for nuclear reactors, and he had ideas for nuclear bombs, but he kept that secret. It turned out that the idea got out nonetheless, and in fact, the Germans were the first to demonstrate a fission reaction occurring in 1938. But by 1945, Szilard was one of the leading voices arguing that nuclear weapons should never be used. So he wanted the bomb that ended up being dropped on Japan, he wanted that to be dropped on an uninhabited island and just invite the Japanese generals to come and see what was going to happen if they didn't surrender. That seems to be a reasonable plan, but the response of the American government was to strip him of all his responsibilities, to push him out of the nuclear weapons project as potentially a traitor, even though he was, I think, arguing on behalf of the human race that we did not want to get into a nuclear war or a nuclear arms race with this technology, that mm-hmm. the technology should be used for peace. And so is the AI community ready to take on the responsibility? I would say we have work to do. Some people argue that what I'm saying is anti-AI, which is ridiculous on so many grounds. First of all, you know, I've been doing AI for 40 years. It's been my life. You know, I wrote a textbook. You know, everyone who's saying this learned AI from the textbook. So it's not anti-AI to say that AI is capable. It seems to me that one reaction we're seeing within the community is that, well, we don't need to worry because actually AI is useless. And we're never going to succeed, so don't worry. right? That seems to be an anti-AI message, right? Saying that AI is capable and that we are going to make progress and we have the potential to create extremely intelligent machines, that's not an anti-AI message, but it's a message that requires us to take our responsibility seriously.
Well, on the other hand, what do you say to the people who think AI is just such a Pandora's box that we should just freeze all AI research in its tracks right now?
So that's an interesting viewpoint. I'm not hearing that at any policy making level, whether it's within industry or government. But certainly, yeah, there are some voices saying this. I think it's really hard to do. There have been some precedents. So with genetic engineering, there was a voluntary moratorium on experiments that modified the human genome in an inheritable way. And that moratorium started in the 70s and actually held until just, I think, last year when a Chinese scientist produced genetically modified babies that inherited a deliberately introduced change. And he apparently has been placed under house arrest. And this has created, I think, another round of very serious discussions in the biology community and reiterating, in fact, that they don't want to go in that direction. So it's possible to do, but AI is much harder to control because, first of all, reproductive medicine has always been subject to scrutiny and oversight. Secondly, you know, reproductive medicine happens, you know, in a lab. You've got to have human donors, this, that, and the other. You can't sort of do it on a whiteboard, whereas AI happens on whiteboards. It happens with people typing on keyboards and scribbling Greek formulas on whiteboards. You can't pass a law saying, okay, any Greek formula beginning with, you know, alpha squared plus beta, look, I got to stop right there. I'm not allowed to write anymore, right? It's just not feasible to constrain research in that kind of way. The approach I think that makes sense is that we work very hard to produce technology that is provably safe. And we also then, once we have that technology and it's been shown in practice that it works, that it also produces, you know, the benefits that we want, the useful personal assistance, the self-driving cars, whatever. Once that that template for safe technology has been established, it is then required that all systems that are sold, that are connected to the internet, conform to this template in much the same way that an app that you want to sell in the app store has to conform to a whole bunch of software safety checks to make sure that it doesn't mess with your phone or steal data from other apps and so on. So, so it's, I think we have a lot of work to do, but there is a way forward that I think will satisfy most of those safety concerns.
Well, as we wind down here, let me propose a scary idea. Is it possible that AI already exists that could one day kill us all? Might technology be in the embryonic stage of learning and sowing the seeds of our eventual destruction, and we just don't realize it yet?
I would be extremely surprised because I've not seen any of the breakthroughs that we need to make. I've not seen that any of them have been made. You know, I could be wrong. It could be that the methods we already have, when they're scaled up onto much bigger machines with much more data and so on, you know, may start to generate much more intelligent behavior than we see from current systems. But I would be extremely skeptical. I think there are good technical reasons to believe that we don't have a solution for general intelligence yet, and we still need to have these ideas.
Okay. Well, before we go, just to end on a positive note, real quickly, give us some examples of the potential benefits of AI in the coming decades, assuming that we actually get this right.
Yeah, I do want to emphasize that you know, the whole reason we're having this discussion is because the potential of AI to be beneficial is so great. If it weren't, people wouldn't be spending hundreds of billions of dollars on trying to develop it. And if you think about it, what AI could do for us in its general purpose form is essentially deliver an economic golden age for humanity, where nobody on Earth need to be struggling with just survival, where in fact everyone could have a perfectly respectable standard of living, because the AI systems can deliver what we already know how to do. You know, we know how to build houses and railways and roads and cars, and we know how to educate children. We just haven't got our act together to do it for everybody, because it's very expensive to do it all properly, and a lot of countries are not at that stage yet.
Sure.
AI systems can do it all very, very cheaply because you don't have to pay expensive people in order for the AI systems to show up and build you a house, for example. So it can deliver a standard of living for everyone on Earth that anyone would find respectable. And if you think about that, it comes to about a tenfold increase in the GDP of the Earth. And in cash terms, what's the value of that? Turns out to be between $10,000 and $20,000 trillion.
Wow.
So that's the upside. And it, when you look at that number, it dwarfs the amount that people are currently investing.
Yeah. Again, the book is called Human Compatible, Artificial Intelligence and the Problem of Control. Stuart Russell, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Professor Stuart Russell for coming on the show. Order his new book, Human Compatible, Artificial Intelligence and the Problem of Control, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. Folks, I've been a small business owner for just about 20 years now, so I know how easy it is to waste a lot of time trying to keep up with taxes. And tax laws are so complicated, at the end of the day, you still might get it wrong. So stop wasting valuable time worrying about your sales tax returns and focus on the things that you actually love about running your business with a little help from Avalara. Avalara simplifies sales tax compliance with real-time rates and automatic filing. Their software seamlessly integrates with the systems you're already using, so it couldn't be easier. Go to Avalara, AVALARA.com/kick to learn more. Avalara, tax compliance done right. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickassNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.